email that I got, it said that I should spend 5 minutes talking about qualifying and the other 20 minutes talking about how my service and so forth contributes to a spiritual way of life. So I'm going to show you. This is the reference material. You all recognize these. This is Courage to Change. Now, I went to Al-Anon in January the 1st of 2003, and I got a sponsor, and I got another book. But I got this book at a little bit later date, and then right up here it says January 03. And as I read through it day to day, the ones that I really liked a lot, I made a note of here on the inside. So there's about 3 or 4 years' worth of reading. And this lives in the pocket of my car door. And every morning when I drive over to Abigail's and park my car, I take the book out and read the Al-Anon directions for the day. You'll recognize this one. You can see that I use it a lot because I've got all sorts of markers in it and so forth, and things I've cut out of newspapers. And this is the Daily Reflections, which is the AA daily book, and I read that when I go inside at Abigail's. This is the traveling version of the 12 and 12. This is how I learned to be myself. So these are my traveling literature. They go into my suitcase every time I pack a suitcase. This is the grapevine. I read the grapevines a lot these days because a lot of them tell stories like mine, but they're very well written. And I don't write well. And I'm going to read a little bit from this later because I like the way it was written, but this was written by an Episcopal bishop. Okay. I was born in Charlottesville, Virginia. I'm an only child. I was the 13th of 14 grandchildren in my father's family, and they were all over the countryside there. I was the only grandchild in my mother's family. She had one sister who had no children. My father had one sister who had no children, and I had three mothers. And I had a very stately grandmother from old Virginia. And so just as a hint, when the family gathered at my grandmother's table for state occasions, all the good stuff was out. As my father says, silver this wide at every place. And she had a bell she rang for somebody to come from the kitchen three doors away and bring more food. And that's where I learned, actually what I learned was old-fashioned table manners. But in the course of my development, I thought that I got that mixed up with morals. And when the issue, and when I got to AA and the word morals was brought up, I thought I had very good morals because I had lovely table manners. And all the other stuff. You know, I was, like I say, I was an only child and had three mothers, and so I was very orderly, and I do homage to my mother every day in the kitchen and the bathroom. We had rules, you know. Nothing goes in the refrigerator without a cover, la-da-da-da-da. And so that's the way I live. I'm an old guy, and that's the way I live. And my father is in the checkbook because he was an office manager and paymaster for construction companies. So I went away to college. I grew up in Charlottesville, Virginia, which is the home of the University of Virginia. And in those days, UVA was all boys. They wore coats and ties to class. They lived in fraternity houses, and they drank. And so anytime in Charlottesville, if you heard a loud noise around the corner in the night, you knew it was those boys from the U. And so I didn't drink because I was a good little Southern Baptist Sunday school boy. And, you know, living by whatever image I thought I understood for myself. But I couldn't stay at home and go to college. So I went to North Carolina and went to a Southern Baptist college in North Carolina, which was even worse. And we couldn't drink either. But I'll tell you how flexible I was. Two of my aunts packed me in the car and drove me 200 miles and dropped me at Wake Forest College. And they got in the car and drove away, and I waved goodbye. And when I turned around, I was a different boy. And one of the things that was different was I knew I was going to drink because that's what college boys did. and it was against the rules there, but we got around the rules, as they always do. And so that's how it started. Older fraternity brothers who would go to the ABC store and buy a bottle of bourbon or something like that, and we would sip at it until the opportunity came to do it again. And so I had this very strange attitude about alcohol, and among other things, I just thought it was part of my growing up process. So after college, I was a biology major, and I was theoretically a pre-med student, and I didn't get into medical school because I flunked organic chemistry. So the next year, I went to UVA. How convenient. I got a cottage in the country, and I started learning how to be a wine connoisseur by drinking wine in screw cap bottles from the back wall of the A&P. And I didn't get into medical school again, so I went down the street. This was 1961. And I went down the street and talked to the Navy recruiter and joined the Navy. Went to OCS and was in the Navy for after that for 3 years, and where they don't drink either on the ship. It's like as long as the ship is underway, drinking is forbidden. And, of course, they couldn't drink on the ship anytime. But if we were tied up to the land, then we'd leave the ship and go and drink. And so it just progressed. It progressed. The last summer I was in the Navy, we were in a Mediterranean deployment. And one of the things you do when you're out of the national waters is you usually have an opportunity. If you're in Europe, you have an opportunity to buy a gallon of duty-free booze. And somehow, because I was the navigator at the time, one of my boys who didn't drink bought a gallon of booze for me. So when I got off the ship, and the ship basically delivered me to Newport, and a couple of weeks later turned around and went to work again, and I'm standing on the pier waving goodbye, and right by each foot I had a box with a gallon of scotch in it. And I went to the BOQ, to the outpatient, the mustering out, and I opened the first bottle of that scotch there. And that was about the 10th or 12th of October. And by Thanksgiving, the 2 gallons of scotch was gone. And I was off for the trot. Because basically, I drank every day until the end of my drinking, May the 29th, 1981. So from 1964 to 1981, I drank every day. And eventually, I was drunk every day. And eventually, because I was so orderly, I was drinking to the full line, which was right up here. Now, in that time, I went to graduate school. I got two graduate degrees. I worked at a couple of good addresses. I met a lovely, smart young woman and got married. I was making a good presentation. I was still dressing well. I had a large, flashy vocabulary. But I got to the point where I was unemployed. And I was unemployed at the end of my drinking for almost 2 years. And it wasn't for lack of trying. I had a file cabinet as long as my arm. I had almost 300 job applications in there, and all of them had failed. And of course, because of the orderly and obsessive man I was, I had saved every one of them. Each application had a little checkbox on it, letters of recommendation, cover letters, copy of publications, yada, yada, yada. And each one was filed in order. And I moved that file cabinet full of failure 3 times before I finally got well enough to say, I don't need to do this anymore. So that was that part. Then, because I was drinking and because I was drunk, when I was 40 years old, I finally decided I needed to address a question that I had refused to ask because I didn't think I was going to like the answer. And I asked myself if I was gay. And I didn't, you know, you don't just say yes or no if you don't know. So I set out, this would have been, oh my God, I was still working in Cambridge. So there was a free newspaper, and it had a lot of interesting stuff in it. So I knew where there were some gay bars. So I got on the train in Harvard Square and got off at Charles Circle and started walking up the street looking for this place called Sporters, which had been a gay bar since World War II. And I couldn't find it. So I went on home, and a few days later, I tried again. Only that time, I went to the top of the hill to the next subway stop at Government Center in Boston, and I started walking down Cambridge Street. And I saw these two guys in jeans, and they were sort of walking close together, and I said, I'll watch them. And they walked, you know, halfway down the hill and darted into an unmarked door. And I thought, And I went in there, and it was Sporters. And it had a big square bar in the front, in the middle of the floor, and tables and dance floor all around it. And I went right into the leading edge of the bar and ordered a beer and drank it down, straight down, and ordered another one. And I'm watching around, and I got the vibe. And I knew the answer to the unasked question. I drank the second beer, and I turned right around and went out the door like I'd been shot at. Oh, you know, that was 5 o'clock in the afternoon, for heaven's sake. No action in there at 5 o'clock. So that was, I was slightly over 40 years old, and I got to AA at 42 and a half. And and that last couple of years of my drinking was really, really grim. Lies, sneaking around. I was too afraid mostly to actually interact with men, but I eventually found a man who was he was willing to look at me and take his clothes off, just to be right to the point about it. So we were having this little backstreet relationship. Anyhow, my wife well, let's see, I got sober in May. It was February of that year, 81. One Saturday morning, I'm sitting in the kitchen drinking my coffee and hiding behind the newspaper. My wife came out of the bedroom, and she said from the kitchen door, "We need to talk." And I said, "Okay, talk." And she said, What have I done, or what can I do to make our marriage more successful? And if that's not right out of the first chapter of the Al-Anon book, I have never read it. And I'm sitting behind my newspaper like this, and I said, "Well, it's not you, it's me." And the clock went tick, tick, and she said, "Are you gay?" And I said, "Yes." And so the last 5 months of my drinking were even worse. So my wife, after we went to couples counseling right away, to find out how to talk to each other and get past this problem. So after several months, she decided that she needed to get away from me for a little while. So she went to Las Vegas to visit some old college friends. And so I and the man with the easy off clothes decided we would go up to Ogunquit Beach, which is on that little bit of the Atlantic coast, that is where New Hampshire meets the ocean. And it was Memorial Day weekend, and they opened the beach on Memorial Day weekend, although there's frequently ice in the water. But it wasn't about water, it was about drinking. So anyway, I had gotten a job. It was a terrible job, but I had it, so I was late getting home, and this is the way I finished. I got a glass of wine, and I tossed it down, and I went to the shower, and I took a shower. I put more wine in the glass while I shaved, and then I dressed, and I had another glass of wine sitting in my drinking chair in the living room before I went out. This is what we call priming the pump. So I went over to pick up this guy in Chelsea, and he was really hysterical, and he said, "I need some help. I need to go to an AA meeting." I said, "Where is one?" He said, "Call him up and ask him." So he took a shower. I called the Central Service office in Boston, and they told me several addresses, one of which I could go to directly. And we went there, and it was a great big speaker meeting. And at the end of it, these two brothers came, and they said, "You want to talk about our program?" And I said, "Oh, it's not me, it's him." And I sat there and listened while they talked for a few minutes, and one of the brothers said, "If your life's a mess and you think you have trouble with alcohol, take the alcohol out of your life and things will get better." So, you know, Mr. Brilliance here. While I'm taking Mr. Helpless back to his place of residence, I said, "You know, that's a good idea. You know, the job, the wife, the money, all that stuff. I'm going to stop drinking for 30 days and let my problems clear up." Well, so we went together, we went to an AA meeting every day. And on Sunday, we looked in the book, and there was a gay meeting in downtown Boston in Old West Church. And we went there on Sunday afternoon, and it was a room full of gay people. People came, it was the only gay meeting in New England, and people came from all over the state and from out of state just so they could sit in an AA meeting and say they were gay. And after the speaker, they went around the room and everybody identified themselves. And when it got to me, I said, "My name is Roy and I don't know who I am." And there was a lot of laughter. And I remember three voices. One said, "Welcome." One said, "Keep coming back." And the third one said, "You're in the right place." And that's how it started. He disappeared before the next Friday. And but he had told me somewhere along the way that he didn't remember going to the first meeting because he was a blackout drinker. And I almost never saw him again after that. But, you know, suddenly I was making this pledge to myself and to my suffering wife to be sober. And that's how it started. And we separated. We got divorced. She kept the house. You know that old line, "What does your wife do?" "Oh, she's a housekeeper." All right. See, it takes me a while to get moving, but then I can. All right. So I went to meetings, I went to meetings, I went to meetings. Now, I'll tell you one little thing. That was a Friday, May the 29th, when I went to AA for the first time. The very next Friday, this is a hallmark day, June the 5th, 1981. Because on that day, there was a special notice from the CDC saying there is a strange cancer appearing in groups of gay men. Wow. And elderly Eastern European Jewish men. And that was the beginning of the AIDS epidemic, publicly. And that's when I got sober. And here I was in a room of gay men, and everybody was terrified. So I have had almost no experience as a gay man at just being sexy. And I'm still alive. And in the, well, while we were still, we used to have big healing services, and we would exchange names of people. And I stopped counting when I had 400 names on my list because I could not carry the burden of guilt and shame, not guilt and shame, grief any longer. And that was, when did I come to Seattle? 1988. That was about 1991. And I just had to stop keeping count because it wasn't over. Now, let me tell you about how I got to Al-Anon. So one of the men I met, you know, Mr. Beautiful, in a meeting, he was in and out of AA, and so he came to me and he said he had to take custody of four little boys because his wife was a drug dealer and user, and Mr. Worthless was living there and doing nothing but doing drugs. And anyhow, so the health welfare department said he needed to take custody of the children. So he was a chef and he wanted to buy this little restaurant on Capitol Hill. And he came and he said, "Can you make a little investment in buying this restaurant?" And I said, "How much are you talking about?" And he said, $5,000. And I thought about it for a few minutes and I said, "Well, I can probably do that." So then he said, "I won't promise you that you'll ever get your money back." So we bought the restaurant called Glow's on Capitol Hill in 1994. And he was with us for about 8 years. And then because he couldn't stay clean and sober, and he couldn't keep his hand out of the bank account or the cash drawer, we had to kick him out of the business. And I still own part of the business. But what happened in the meantime before that was that we were sort of attached at the hip. I really loved him dearly, and he loved me, and he tried to treat me well, but, you know, he was dishonest and all the rest of that stuff. And I was left standing on the street corner waiting for him to pick me up way too many times, and I was overwrought about it. So finally, and this is how all this ties together, Leo used to live in a big house up on 14th Street on Capitol Hill, and at Christmas he would have a big holiday party, and he would invite all of his AA friends and everybody else he knew. And we would go there, and the Cy Turner Trio would play, and we would have tons of catered food. And so I met this guy. Many of you know Dave D, and he was standing there, and I met him, and we talked for about a half an hour about the virtues of Al-Anon, which I later found out he had only started himself. And I said, where do you know? So, and I listened to him, and I thought that was really cool. So that was about mid-December, and on New Year's Eve, I'm sitting in my apartment by myself, absolutely miserable. And so I diagnosed myself, and I said, honey, you need to go to Al-Anon, because you're sitting here feeling shitty because of Robert, my business partner. And so the next morning, New Year's Day, 2003, I went down to the boathouse where I knew Dave would be, because he's very vain about going every morning of the week. And there he was. And I said, Dave, where do you go to Al-Anon? And he told me about the Sunday Fresh Start, which meets in a University of Washington building. And I went there. And, of course, at Sunday Fresh Start, they don't like people to say they're double winners. These are hardcore Al-Anon people. So I didn't say that, and I actually didn't say much of anything else, but I went there most Sundays for about 5 years, and I did the steps. And two or three of the people I sponsored in AA asked me to do the Al-Anon steps with them, too. And I don't know, if you have never seen the step book for Al-Anon, you should look for one. It is a work of art. It's about 40 pages of questions. It is a trudge. But I did it. I did it for myself, and I did it about six more times with other people. And, you know, and I learned things over and over again. Okay, so I have a couple of things here because I'm supposed to talk about my spiritual life. Well, I'm a work in progress. What can I tell you? So here's a line. It even brought up a memory of the year I went to UVA and took German. The word is, the German word, the only one I can remember is Lebensbejahung. And the sort of direct translation of that is yesify life. Say yes to life. Affirm. And the piece it goes with here is called, the secret of life is to say yes all the time. Because when you're old, you don't want to say, I'd wish I had done this, or I wish I had done that. And this is a piece from a book written by a bishop. I love the book. And it says, he's speaking about a different kind of bondage. And this is right in our line. The bondage of self-centeredness, the bondage of being motivated by survival, the bondage of insecurity and fear, the bondage of the struggle to become, which prohibits each of us from the celebration of our being. The bondage of assuming that in order to build myself up, I must tear down somebody else. Well, I believe that. I embrace it. We use the relieve me of the burden of self. I've known that prayer ever since I got sober. And I mean, my friends at Abigail's laugh at me. One of the ways that I'm always manifesting the crankiness I am is in my car. So over the past couple of years, I have been trying, and mind you, I'm doing this at 8 o'clock in the morning, going home from Abigail's, down to Mercer Street and up the hill. And I'm watching to see who's on this side of the road trying to get into the traffic. Pedestrians, dog walkers, skateboards, bicycle riders, baby carriages, other drivers stuck in a side street. And I stop and let them get in front of me. And I try to be thoughtful. What is the mindful. Mindful of others. And I, you know, people who I've wiggled my finger at to get into the traffic know I have done that. But a lot of the stuff I do, I don't want to be noticed for, and I don't call attention to myself. And that's the basis of my spiritual life, and I learned it here. Thank you.
Thank you.